Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. This is Jen, and for new and returning listeners, you may know you can find the podcast on Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. The podcast is also on several different formats such as Google Play, iTunes, and Spotify, as well as TuneIn and another one I always forget. But I'm very excited about Spotify. That's amazing. And I am super, super happy to have with me today New Yorker, even though she doesn't live here anymore, but never leaves your heart, Lilium Rivera, the author of The Education of Margot Sanchez, which came out, it debuted last year.
Yes.
And the paperback is coming out again as of this recording.
It came out, yes, this month.
Yes, this month being May. Month.
Yeah. Oh, no, it came out in March. I should know this.
March. Oh, yeah. Wow.
What month are we in?
We're in May.
It just came out.
And the Bronx Book Festival is tomorrow.
That's right.
Which Lilium will be at.
Yes, I am.
So hopefully y'all already have this on the agenda. You bought your umbrellas, your slickers, all that stuff, and are going to be headed out because it's free. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I'm super happy to be here. It's really, and I'm really excited about tomorrow, and it's just always nice to be in New York. I miss it. It's nice to get my fill. I go back to LA, and then I come back again later on. So
sorry about the weather, though.
Yeah, I was like, this isn't cute.
This is wah, wah, wah.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I felt.
It's like, I check my weather thing every day now.
I know, it's weird. I'm like, okay.
It's funny because I keep wanting to call your book The Miseducation of
yes.
Margot Sanchez, and that's a play, I feel like that's a Freudian slip. But also very much due to Lauryn Hill.
That title didn't come from me.
Oh, okay.
And so the title came up and they emailed me and they're like, what do you think about this? And I was like, yeah, that's a play on Lauryn Hill's.
Uh-huh.
I'm down for that. And I don't think the person who came up with it didn't really know, didn't get the connection.
Oh, okay.
Of the Lauryn Hill connection.
Sales might not understand.
Right.
That.
I was just like, you guys don't get that? It's awesome. So I was down, but yeah, it was funny. So it worked well for me. But yeah, I've had people email me with the miseducation.
Yeah, by accident, like, oops.
Yeah.
Well, it plays into everything that's going on. So do you want to summarize? Do you feel like there's a summary for this book? It's kind of like, you know, that tagline that people say, Margot Sanchez. And,
yeah,
shenanigans.
Exactly. that pitch, elevator pitch. Yes. The Education of Margot Sanchez is about a girl who's forced to work at her father's supermarket after she gets caught stealing her father's credit card to buy some fancy clothes for her fancy private school that she attends, and she spends the whole summer learning about her family, sort of like the self-discovery of her family, the flaws within her family, even class and race, and also the beauty of the Bronx, beauty of like a summer in the Bronx, which I felt was something that I grew up in. I really loved summers in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's outside, everyone's semi-naked.
Mm-hmm.
There's music always, there's live music somewhere. So there was always something like a little taste of freedom I felt during the summer. And I kind of want to just capture a little bit of that.
So I'm not from the Bronx. I'm from Long Island in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not exactly, you know, on par. But there are distinctions, right?
Yeah.
And with yours and Liz Acevedo's book, I fell so much in love. I gobbled your books up in yours in a day.
Yes.
Hers in 3 days only because I was traveling. So, and I was just like, these are, they're not, I hesitate to say New York stories, but they are New York stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I feel so connected to this material. And then when I say the miseducation, it's this kind of relearning.
Yes.
For Margot and everything she finds out. Because it's not, let's tie this up in a pretty bow at the end.
No, it's not for Margot. I mean, she's kind of living a bit of a privileged life in the sense that her family wants to live a privileged life, and they kind of, you know, they want to portray that life, so they live in a nicer neighborhood, and they have these two supermarkets, but they're kind of failing in a way, but they don't want to kind of admit that, and they put her in a private school, but she's not a scholarship kid.
Mm-hmm.
So there's really, like, these are really specific decisions that they're making. And with Margot, she's learning. She's taking in what her parents are kind of feeding her and knowing that she's like pretty much the brown hope of that family in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll do whatever she can to just sort of make sure that she toes the line of that privilege in a way. So She denies a lot of her stuff. She denies her curls. She straightens her hair out. She denies what she likes for the school because she thinks that's what's going to make her really fit in. And then she's stuck in this supermarket world where it's, again, she's like the outsider, right? So she doesn't fit in that world either.
She's la princesa.
Yeah, she's like princesa, right? So she's like the really catered, sheltered one. But what I love about Margot, even though she's flawed in a lot of ways, is I love that she, you know, she's, I could understand the desperation. Like, I could understand her desperation. I could understand Jasmine, the cashier's desperation. You know, everyone is kind of desperate to portray themselves in a way that they think is going to get them their ticket, or, you know, get them their ticket out of there, or get them the ticket to where they think is going to help them, you know, make them happy. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone is really happy.
Well, it's all about masks, right?
Yes.
There's so many. Every person in this family has a mask.
I'm fascinated. I love that. I'm sure you've been through this, like where you enter institutions or anywhere, conferences, anything, and you are probably the only person there. Like, I'm the only Latina there. I'm definitely usually the only Puerto Rican from the Bronx there. You walk in and you have to, what mask am I going to put on? You know, I grew up like that, knowing fully, like, well, like I was the first one to go to college, you know, go away for college, and just trying to navigate what people's perceptions or misconceptions of what the Bronx was like.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
that still happens now, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, you wear all these masks. You speak in code. I speak in Spanish and English. These things that you do to sort of like survive and try not to be authentic, but also to be able to survive.
And it also means growing up, which means the lack of protection. So for, like, Margot, she's not protected anymore,
right,
in a way. And maybe she never realized she was.
Yes. Yes, right? Because she was always the princesa, and then all of a sudden, they're like, oh, now you're, you know, what does that title mean anymore?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't really mean anything. I was just really thinking about that moment of, for kids, when the push is for you to excel. You know, for sure. That's my parents' pushes for us to excel. But sometimes that comes at a cost.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I always thought, like, you know, I had a brother, a younger brother, who got a scholarship to go to a boarding school in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And it was a boarding school with people, you know, kids, billionaires, like money that. Mm-hmm. And for those 4 years that he was away, we did not communicate with him. And this we didn't know about this until after the fact. He couldn't call home and just say, hey, I'm having problems.
He couldn't?
He couldn't in a way that, because he had such a great opportunity, he couldn't come home and say, this is hard for me. Wow. I need money for this. You don't understand what I'm competing with. My parents didn't understand that. My parents knew that this was an opportunity that couldn't afford to fail.
Oh, so he didn't feel comfortable saying those things. Okay.
Right. So I always thought of how that affected him throughout his whole life as a kid, dealing with that, you know. And I just sort of want to write about the burden of what young kids sometimes, that burden of being the brown hope or being, of excelling. You live here in America, and what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, what's the American dream at what cost, you know? Mm-hmm.
So would you also call Margot Sanchez a feminist novel?
Feminist.
Because she's coming into her own, which means recognizing there's a responsibility and recognizing, oh, this is what society expects me to be. And that societal expectation comes from the patriarchy.
Right.
And then we see how the dudes, you know, the discrepancy she keeps talking about between her and her brother and her mother and her father.
I love that she gets to see the shift of even her mother and how her mother made whatever decision she made to be with her father or to stay with the father. Like, and for Margot to just maybe just still be angry, but just be able to accept it.
Yeah.
Like, to understand that, the system that's in play, you know?
Yeah.
That, to me, was really powerful in the sense of what I wanted to try to write about. Because, you know, obviously, I grew up in a family, you know, where my father was really the man of the hour, and then everyone kind of falls underneath.
Yeah.
But then he had these two daughters who were really outspoken and very, you know,
didn't know what to do with that.
Right. He was just like shaking his head every time, like, why can't they just, you know, cook and clean, you know, do all the things that you're supposed to do? And we're like, no. So, I mean, and I'm sure in a lot of ways he's proud of that, but also I'm sure it takes him aback, because that's not, for most of his family, a lot of my family, that's not the way you're supposed to be, you know? So, yeah, so it's interesting. So a feminist, yeah, I guess, yeah, to see Margot's shift, to see her journey, like that transformation at the end, that was what I needed her to do, and how it's tied to her, the poet Julia de Burgos. And Julia de Burgos is such a feminist icon, and her poetry is so powerful, and just she writes about that stuff, and I just wanted even a little bit of that, of just the moment, like a seed of it being planted in Margot, so that later on, hopefully in that future book of whatever it is, that you can see that it'll flourish, you know?
Yeah. I think also the success of this is that, forgive me for saying, but Margot is kind of a brat. She is spoiled. And when we are introduced to her and how she reacts, you know, she's like, my best friend left me. Everyone, the world is against me.
Right.
And you're like, whoa. You know me, 37-year-old me. So I can only imagine how you writing it is like, Margot, get a grip.
I love that. I love flawed characters that do questionable.
But she's not annoying. You know, like, I know you must have, you've read those books where you're just, I know we're not supposed to think in terms of likable and unlikable, but there's sometimes you're just like, I can't stand this person. And I don't, it's because you don't understand.
Yeah, no, because I understand exactly why she's acting the way she is.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And you still want to shake her.
Exactly. And you want to follow her progression, because you're like, I know you're going to get it. I know you're going to get it.
I'm like, girl, get it. No, I mean, I totally get it, because she is. But it makes sense, because she's the princesa. That's the way she was brought up. And now they're trying to pull it back in a weird way, which is just, it doesn't make sense.
She's not a doormat either, because she makes questionable choices.
Right.
But they are her choices. And I think that also leads into her being this character. You're like, okay, I totally get you. I get why you think your best friend left you. I get why you're going with this to see if you can get to that party.
Right.
At the end of the summer. Like, I get why the pressure. But she also sees and questions things. And I think that acts that multi-tiered character that makes it identifiable.
Yeah, she's the person. I understand her. In a way that I know some people are like, oh, no, I can't. She's too bratty. But I'm like, it's okay. I'm like, because I understand that character. And also, not all characters have to be likable.
Yeah, I actually like Margot. But I think that's kind of like, there's this kind of resonance.
Yeah, for sure.
So when you were submitting this story, how was that process? Because like we said, okay, she's a bit spoiled. You know, some people will be like, I don't like her. And she's POC.
Right
about the Bronx. I add all these things. And you were blessed with Zareen, who is a guest on the podcast. I adore Zareen.
I love her. She's a great editor. Yeah. She's so good.
Yeah. She keeps it real. I love that about her. She's just like, but what was that progression for you in terms of, like, okay, Margot Sanchez is going out into the world. Did people seem to get it?
You know, when I went out on submission, I mean, my agent was great, and he's really, his name is Eddie Snyder, and he's really thorough, like, gives me notes and stuff, so we worked on it beforehand. So when it was going out, we would get, you know, some publishers that were like, oh, we already have a book that's set in a bodega.
This and I was like, what?
My story's not in a bodega.
First of all.
And then the thing is that, the funny thing was, like, I knew which story they were talking about, because it was like a Latina character and it was in a bodega, and I was like, I know who we're talking about. So so I'm like, and you know, I was telling this to Eddie, I'm like, I know the story and it's not the same story. But you know,
they're pigeonholing you already.
The question of, like, they could only have one story, right? And so, but Zareen was really quick. Her assistant was the one who found the book.
Oh, Makisha?
Yes.
Makisha's there? Yeah.
She was the one who found the book, and she gave it to Zareen, and then Zareen read it. And they were pretty quick at wanting it. You know, it was really smooth. I've never had any, you know, the editorial process was really smooth, and the questions she asked really kind of shaped it into what I wanted it to be. But it didn't really change as much as what it was when I first submitted it. It was great. I was really nervous about everything. I was nervous about the cover. I was nervous about the editorial process. I was nervous about Spanish, all that stuff. But nothing, I didn't ever have to worry about it, because Zareen was really open to everything.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So it wasn't, I lucked out in a lot of ways. No one, I didn't have a problem. Like, she, I think she had, when we first met, she was like, oh, maybe we want to shoot the cover and like use a real person. I was really nervous. I was just really nervous, right? I was just like, are you going to find somebody? I'm going to have to take out my cousins because I'm like, it's like, you're nervous. But then they came back with this illustration of this artist, and I was like, okay, I'm down. And yeah. It worked out really wonderfully.
The hardcover edition is very beautiful.
Yeah. It's great. They did a really great job. I was really happy with that. But you know, it's like a first book. I was really nervous. I've heard all the scary stories. They've been pretty good.
I've noticed this thing where they're going straight to illustration because they don't have the photos, or maybe they just don't want to put the money into it. So a lot of the POCs we are seeing on covers tend to be illustrations.
Right? I mean, there's something to say about like a real person on a cover.
Like, I just saw Dawn Quigley's, hers is Apple in the Middle, it's a Native American.
Right.
A YA coming out, okay. And it's gorgeous, the girl's brown skin, but you know, it's not like the headgear, it's like she's wearing a t-shirt, she's wearing a locket, she's wearing like, I forget what the stones are called, but you know, the turquoise stump, earrings, and it's just like, it's gorgeous, and her hair, you know, like her features aren't these kind of like European tiny nose, Barbie, and like
it's like a big deal.
No, she got, the artist is white, for that book, and she got full lips, you know, like a bulbous nose, you know, big like cheeks and
just
stuff,
like,
and she's
a
smiling.
Real girl,
it looks great.
That's a big deal. Like, I remember when I was, they were asking me for some input and for the cover, and I always have a Pinterest board because that's usually how I find inspiration, and so I sent them my Pinterest board, and all the Pinterest board is full of Puerto Rican girls from the Bronx, just really, and you could see where the artist got some of inspiration, which was great.
Yeah,
because I'm like, I would have been really sad. I've
been devastated. This is like, here's my book. Here it is. It's really good. I hate my cover, but I really like the inside.
Because I've heard those stories. I've heard so many stories like that. It's upsetting.
It feels like also artists are pushing back more or giving as much. And then publishers are hopefully listening.
Yes. I mean, I think it makes a difference. It's people, when you see a cover and readers really fall behind it, they're just like in awe. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had young girls be like just so happy for the cover. Mm-hmm. Just to have it. You know? That's a big deal.
Yeah, I know. EB. Her new book, Pride, coming out, and that, like, having an Afro-Latina with an afro, a guy with a shaven head and stuff, that's so amazing. And, like, this chrome.
Yeah, that's a beautiful cover. Gorgeous. Like, that's nice. Like, you can tell that they made it a point to really pay attention.
Yeah. So Evie was raving about your book before it come out.
Evie's great.
She's great. Champion. So she went to Clarion and you went to Clarion. Did you go together?
No. She went way before. Because I went just like 2015. So it was recently. But and I didn't know Evie then. Because we just met each other when our books came out last year. But I loved Clarion. It was the last big writing thing that I did.
So were you there for, do they have it in categories of kid lit, and do they kind of parse it all out that way?
No, because it's really geared for short stories.
Okay.
So it's like a 6-week course or workshop in San Diego, and they have a different author each week.
Whoa.
And they lead the workshop that week, and you produce a short story almost every week.
What?
Yes, it was crazy.
What?
Never done anything like that.
That sounds amazing and terrifying.
No, it was awful. I was like living off of ginger beer and sugar. I was like, this is intense. I pulled my back. I was just so stressed. But it was great because it forced me to create stories. Okay. And because all of it is geared to fantasy and science fiction, it was just great for me to be able to be creative in those worlds. It was the first time. I love reading those books. I grew up reading like Ray Bradbury and A Clockwork Orange was one of my big books that I read a lot. But I didn't know I didn't know like the workshop stuff. Like, I didn't understand that whole world. I didn't do an MFA, so I was kind of like nervous about all that. But it was cool. And the people I was workshopping ended up being great. And I was able to just workshop stories that I felt spoke to me in a lot of ways. Mm. You know, horror or fantasy or near future stuff, but always tied to like social justice themes political aspects, or talks about the island, Puerto Rico, and all these things that I really want to write about. So it was great.
But you have been writing, and you have been, you teach, or you taught?
Yes, I teach, now. I've been writing like short stories and stuff before my book came out.
So how did that transition happen for you? Because I don't want to assume, like, I don't think you stop. It's like, okay, I'm not a short story person anymore. Bye.
Yeah. I really love short stories. I think it happened at the same time in a weird way. Like, I wrote young adult novels for whatever reason. Whenever I think of novels, I think of the young voice.
Okay.
And then when I do short stories, for the most part, it's literary or, you know, adult, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, and it's always, I try to do, if it's literary or if not, it's like horror or feature kind of stuff.
Oh, cool.
Okay. So I always was try to do those short stories, and it's been a while since I had a short story. I had one short story this year, and I'm trying to do one a year. One a year is just hard. Short stories are hard.
They really are.
They are.
Kick in the butt. And people don't recognize this.
No.
Well, it's interesting because so many anthologies are coming out for young readers now.
Yes. Yes.
As I feel like I hear about one all the time, and I said, do we all know how to write short stories? Because it's not easy, friends.
It's not easy.
So not easy, no matter what the audience.
It took a lot of years. It like took years.
Yeah.
To write one short story. I'm doing a workshop in the next month, and it's just for science fiction and short fantasy writers. They all gather in this one place, and I'm going to go for a week. And you bring a short story, and I haven't done that in a while. And it's a short story. I think I've written this short story last year. I'm up to, like, the 7th or 8th draft of this story, and it's still not there. Like, it's not even close.
Same.
Right?
Same.
It's just not easy writing short stories.
It's not.
So, yeah, I don't know. All these anthologies, I'm like, I'm always in awe.
Yeah, and the timeline is short for those too.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Especially for the kidlit ones. Those are like really fast. I had a year, but that's because they kept extending the deadline for ours. They kept saying, your publate has changed. And I said, that's not okay. But it actually is okay because no one's handed in their story.
Right. You're
just
like waiting. And
you're
like, when do I have to
hand it in? Yeah, it's horrible to tell someone, I need a short story in 6 months. Thanks. Or 9 months.
Yeah.
And for some people, they're really like, this story just happened and it just came, blah, blah, blah. And then other people are like, so I've been writing this for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I guess now is the time.
That's what I feel like. It really does feel like a puzzle. And, you know, I fly or whatever, like I have time and I'll like, okay, let me dedicate a couple of hours on this short story. And I'm like, it's still missing something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't know what it is. Yeah. But, all right, here's the other draft. There's another draft of it, you know.
Yeah.
To see how much more. The goal is to try to publish one a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, ideally, I would love to do a short story collection. I'm not ready yet. I think I need to learn more of how to produce one.
Do you feel that via Clarion you learned a bit more about, I hesitate to say structure, but the expectations in a story? You know, like sometimes you might pack too much in a story. Maybe.
Yeah.
It's a frame story, which means it's three things within another story. But that's not overly overloading it in a way.
I mean, I don't know if I learned how to definitely, like, I don't know if you do this, but when people critique your stuff, I know that there's something wrong with what they're critiquing, but I know they can't fix it. So to me, those are like alarms, like, you know, like, oh, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't work. Okay. So that means I have to fix it. Mm-hmm. Your suggestion is not really going to work for my piece usually, but it's my way of saying, okay, it's not working. It was great for me to have that. I feel it was also just a great dialogue to just speak to writers who were very different from my upbringing and my reading, and just have them talk about works of other people. Karen Joy Fowler was one of our authors who taught. I love her so much. She's so amazing to me and just an amazing writer. And she's been doing it for so long, and she's just like, oh, I've been doing this for so long because I was just not the better writer of all of them. I've just been, because I'm quit. I just don't. And that to me that's my life. Like, I'm like, I'm not the strongest writer, but I have the ambition to like just keep showing up. Just like, I'm just going to try. Just having that and being able to speak about like, oh, have you read this author? You might like this. I feel that's that, if anything, of any workshop, that to me is enough mm-hmm. for it to be worth it. If someone can talk to me about, like, you should read this book, mm-hmm. that might help you. Mm-hmm. It's definitely an enigma for me to like short stories, but I love them.
I love them too. They can be amazing.
Mm-hmm. When you read one and then you want to throw the short story collection across the room because it's so good. And you know, you're like, damn. I want to do that.
How did they come?
Yeah.
It's so small. How is it so small? It's like looking at those paintings on like the heads of pins. Yeah. Like, how did they do that?
It's so true. I love it. I love
it. As we said at the top of the episode, you're a New Yorker who now lives in LA. So how is that transition, especially the writing life?
Yeah. Well, my background's in entertainment journalism. My last job, before I moved to LA, I was working at Latina magazine as their entertainment editor, and then I moved to LA to work at E! Entertainment. So I was working at E! Entertainment for like 6 years or something. So that was the job that got me out to LA.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, and I was working like fashion police and red carpet coverage, all that stuff.
Wow.
So I did that for a long time.
How intense was that?
You know, it was intense and fun if you like that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I'm definitely like a pop culture kind of person. Mm-hmm. Or I was. I'm not as intense now. But, yeah, I was really into that world and it was fun. But red carpet, award shows, all those things take a toll. And it's a real young person's kind of game because after a while, you don't want to hang out. I don't want to go to that party. Like a lot of people I'm sure would love to, but I just don't care at one point. So that was the thing. So I didn't really start writing short stories or anything until I moved out to LA and I started taking like UCLA extension classes, just like intro to fiction and just really basic classes. And then I started trying my heart out, trying to figure out if I could do a novel.
So how long was that?
I would say like, I don't know, like 8 years ago.
Oh, okay.
One of the magazines I was in folded and I didn't have a job. So I was like, well, might as well just try to write a novel. Mm-hmm. Like I was like, well, there's no excuses. Yeah. Can't say it was a job or something. It was just more like, so I did that and I wrote a novel. It wasn't good. And then I wrote the second one and that was Margot Sanchez.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. So how is your process? Is it just butt in chair, word count? Because I see your tweets. I see your accountability tweets.
I do. I sit down. I do it every day. I try to do it every day.
Is your agent on Twitter too?
Is Eddie watching you? Which is the weirdest thing.
I know Zareen's on Twitter.
I know. Zareen's good. Like, she won't know, but my agent will email me and say, hey, how's it going? I saw your tweet. I'm like, damn. I forget that he doesn't tweet a lot, so I'm just like, you know, blah blah blah, and then he's just like, hey, okay. No, so he's fine. Yeah, I just do it every day. Like, I used to take a class in LA, his name is Al Watt, and he has this thing where it's a 90-day novel. And you produce a novel or a draft of a novel in 90 days.
That sounds better than Nano.
Yes, to be honest. Right. Yeah. Which I've never done Nano, but it's like, you know, similar kind of stuff that you just have to force yourself to do it. And I took this class or this course with him and a couple of times, and that's how I produced the first novel. I feel like drafts, I could produce a draft fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. It's just the rewrite process takes a long time. You know, rewriting takes a while. It's like years.
So you kind of vomit it out.
Yes.
And then rework.
And then
rather than
back.
Edit as you go along.
I don't know if that doesn't really work, but that's the way I do it. Mm-hmm. I could produce a draft of a novel fairly quickly. It's just rewriting is going to take a time. But I like I like the creation of it. Mm-hmm. It's just the rewriting kills me.
Rhoda was saying something. Rhoda Beleza. She was saying she has to just write this crap draft because she said she was an editor. And she said, if I edited as I went, I would never get anything done.
No, it would take forever because then I'll second guess every little sentence that I put down. And I don't know, I really do believe that your story lies within you, so you just have to take it out first and throw it out there and then we'll go back. So I'll have an idea of, like, in a way, what I'm aiming for, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I do an outline, which I never look at after I outline it.
Same.
Right? I just outline it, okay, and then I go back. If I go back, it's, like, totally different. Because it's just the journey, you know? You want to be able to wear your story loosely and just be able to write it. So that's what I do. But I do try to write every day. Because there's something to write. I'm not writing a novel or working on a novel. There's a short story of the hundreds that I haven't finished that could be reworked. So there's always something.
Well, we talked about, you were saying the criticism process and mm-hmm. the workshop. And something that I know people have struggled with, and maybe you see this also as a teacher, is what to do when you get also. You have this big ass stack from 12 people, and they said, this is how you fix it. Or this is what I thought, you know, like you said, they're not telling you. Maybe the instructor is giving you better, but everyone else is just, I don't understand.
Right.
So how do you kind of collate and process that?
It's funny. I went through a workshop, the first workshop for a couple of people in my class that I'm teaching at UCLA. And this is the first time I've ever workshop. So my take, the way I handle it is I will take in all, you know, like I do, like everyone else does, take all the notes, you know, people are talking, giving mm-hmm. you notes. This is what's working. This isn't what's working. More of this or not. I take 2 days because I don't do anything for 2 days at least. You got to let that process, right? All the criticism. And then, you know, devise a plan. I go through every single criticism and I write it all out. They said, you know, in bullet point mm-hmm, form. Mm-hmm. And then what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Right, so if someone tells me, the character should be older or something, I don't know if I'm going to do that, but I'll know that I have to change something with the character. And then I just go through it mm-hmm. every day, new draft. If the new draft needs that a character who's older, all right, let's do a version of the character older. If I can, the draft has to be the mother dies, let's do a version of that.
For stories specifically, let's say, do you just do a full rewrite?
For short stories? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What?
I have like versions. To see if it makes sense. Sometimes it doesn't, and you could tell right away. I feel like I try to see if it makes sense. Mm.
So does anything, do you find carry over, or just kind of keeps changing?
It transforms a little bit. Then sometimes you feel like you're losing sight of it. I don't know. I always have to go back to what the character wants, because everything mm-hmm. is character-based, right? So I'm just trying to figure out what is it the character wants, and sometimes I just don't know. I think I know. I think it's on a superficial level, I think I know.
Yeah.
And that's when you're not digging deep enough. Yeah. So it's always going back further into, like, what is it that she wants? What's her backstory? Oh, what happened to her when she was that age?
Yeah.
These are the decisions that she's making. This is why she's making those decisions, because of this. Mm-hmm. So it just takes a while.
It does.
The versions that I have.
Yeah.
And then you have to give it to someone else to see if it even makes sense.
Yeah. And get your good crew.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You have to get like two or three people who you trust, who they know what they're talking about.
Because those workshops, that was a big thing with me in the MFA. It's like, I'm like, y'all don't know what the hell you're talking about.
And also not reading the same thing you're reading. Like, not reading the same, just like broaden your reading material. I'm always like, for my young adult book class that I'm leading, I'm always like, oh, you should be reading this. If you're writing about this, maybe you need to read these people.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. If everyone's in this MFA program and they're talking about the same books that everyone else is talking about.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know if that works for me.
Yeah. I also wonder, because I've noticed this, and I'm not trying to be shiesty or shady. I feel if people don't read out.
Yeah.
If everyone's only reading poetry, which is actually a really good thing, because I think poetry is amazing.
Yes.
And you can get so much from it. But if you write maybe fiction and you never read fiction, you only read poetry, how does that define?
Right.
In a good and a potentially negative way. If you only read kid lit.
Yes.
Do you read other things, or is it this kind of, because the conversations have been like, well, adult lit doesn't respect kid lit, so fuck right. adult lit. And it's like, well, I agree. I think there's total elitism. I do. I think right. kid lit is looked down upon, mm-hmm. unreasonably so. Mm-hmm. I don't think that means either one is not valuable.
No. I feel like if you're like writing a story, like I was specifically talking to one of my students, and they were like, if you're writing a story about ghosts or something, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, have you read Jasmine Ward's latest book?
Yeah.
I'm like, you have to read that these chapters and try to analyze them for how she did that. Mm-hmm. And read YA. And read poetry. Like, it's like,
yeah.
Like, you have to be, if I'm not reading poetry, what is wrong with me?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, seriously. I need to get at least 6 poetry books in this year, or else I'm gonna smack myself.
No, I was like so excited over the weekend that I read 2 poetry collections. I was just like so out of it because I haven't had a chance to read, and I'm like, needed.
Laylee Long Soldiers, Whereas. Have you read it?
I have to read that one.
It's so good.
It's so good.
Her form is ridiculous. She just like goes all over, and you're just like, she does what Tiamba Jess does essentially, which is like, you can read this forward and backwards.
I like that.
And diagonally. And you're just like, How did you do that?
Yeah, I was reading Javier Unaccompanied. Mm. And he's talking about, he's Guatemalan, I think, and he's talking about being undocumented. And the work is just, it's amazing. I couldn't believe it. What is his last name? I forgot. But his name is Javier something. The collection is called Unaccompanied. Mm. And then I was reading Joseph. I can't get everyone's last name. His collection is called Shadowboxing. Yeah. And they're both really good. Really good stuff. I was like, yes.
Tommy Pico's was... I haven't read Tommy's latest junk, but I really like the other one.
That's good stuff.
Yeah. Tommy's was really good.
That makes for a good combination, is being able to speak, bring in all those other sources when you're like talking about YA. Why aren't you bringing in those sources of literary or poetry? Like, this will help you with your work.
Yeah
To me, that's what I want.
And I've noticed that. I think the people I gravitate, because I think there's so many great kid lit writers, period, whether they write other genres or not, or read it. But I did realize that the ones I tend to gravitate to tend to write other genres.
Yes.
Like the Renee Watsons and the Liz and the Jasons, because they are poets.
Right.
That's and then so they true. Do this and you're like, oh, yeah, that totally makes sense why I'm totally into this.
Right.
It's you are so poets. True. Or like so you true. And Ebi,
right.
if you also write...
Right, other all this forms. Stuff, like speculative stuff. Yeah, you're right. That's so funny. I didn't think about that, but you're so true.
Yeah, because I feel like there's a consistency or this variability.
Mm-hmm.
But also for some people, I'm like, yeah, this is a Jason book. This is a Kwame book. Right. I know your books.
You're very specific, and you could tell it's their voice in a way. They've developed a voice. That is so true about that. I didn't think about us, of Evie as well, just writing other stuff.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, Lainey Taylor, too.
I
don't know if she's written too much adult, but she, you know, sometimes her books, her characters are like teen, not teens anymore. They're like in college, they're in their early 20s and stuff like that. Okay. You know, they still market it as YA.
Yeah, and I'm like, but it's a little bit older.
But she's 20.
kind of pushing it.
So I was like, but you're not marketed as that's that. But funny. That's cool. So I feel like certain people kind of skirt that line.
Yes.
And they're just like, I can do whatever I want.
Right. It's just sort of what I want to do is just be able to write whatever I want. Eventually just write what you love. I don't know. I just think it's weird when people say they want to write YA and they haven't read any YA.
That's very bonkers to me.
I'm like, what?
Or like they don't like kids. You know what I mean? Like people are like, I don't really like kids.
That I don't
but
really
I want to write for them. And I'm like.
I'm like, I've never met anyone like that. Would be really, I don't know how I would react. It would be funny.
I seen some people, they didn't say it, but you could see when they talked it. I'm like, you don't really like kids. You really don't like them.
How are you going to do this? This is all about. To me, I mean, honestly, to me, the big thing is being able to meet kids. I'm like, that to me is like so important. And the best part of being a writer, of a YA writer, is being able to go to school visits and talk to kids and talk to them about writing and stuff. That's I love that. I love that. I don't know how anyone else, but some people don't like that.
Yeah, that's bonkers to me too. It's like, nope. I want to hang with the adults. And
like, okay.
Schools have money. Like, make some money.
I mean, you could do that, or I like hanging out with the kids. They're fun. And also, how could you not? How else are you gonna write about YA if you're not hanging out with kids? Like, you gotta see how the kids are talking. It's like the rhythm of how they talk, and it's a whole different thing. You just can't pick that up off of watching TV.
Exactly. I think most writers tend to work out their stuff.
Yes, in their work. I get that. And I totally get that. Yeah.
And some of them may be working out some stuff from high school. That's all I'm saying.
It's not like, look, I mean, there will always be the same themes that will be circling around every time I write.
Yeah.
Back, right? It's not possible for me to like deny that. I'll always go back to those themes. But, you know, I'm not trying to rewrite my high school years.
They're so done.
I'm glad. I'm not trying to live that life, you know?
I actually really liked high school.
But I keep, like, for kids, like, I don't know, like, it's a big deal for you to go to college and stuff, but I'm just like, it's really hard to be in a space where it's exciting because you're learning a lot about new things, but it's also scary. You're just like, you know, you're stuck in a world and an environment full of people that you don't know. And usually you're the only person of color. And and then how you cope with that, with those moments. Like for me, I cope by drinking a lot. Then that's a depressant, and then I was depressed. And so none of that was helping, you know. And I didn't have my outlet. Like my outlets were always writing. Just even writing. I didn't write fiction till I moved, but just writing, because that was the way I used to cope with everything. Like living in the projects, I would just write all my drama out, everything, violence, whatever was going on, I would write it out. But when I got to college, I didn't have that. Like for whatever reason, I stopped. So it just took a long time for me to finally get out of that experience of college. College is right for everyone, not right away, you know.
Yeah. And those spaces, I commuted, I went to city. It's very different to commute than it is to live on site.
Right.
Like, it is such a different experience. Like, just going to dorms for workshops, and, like, I taught at a girls' school briefly for one summer. I said, holy shit. You're really encapsulated. You're kind of, like, stuck.
It's a little, like, microcosm. Like, you're being tested in ways that you didn't know you were supposed to test and have these discussions about certain things. The education part of it, because I was a history major, so I love talking about history and learning about new liberation movements, you know, all that stuff that I was, that informed some of my writing now. But in between that, you're dealing with, I don't know, stupid shit like sororities and
who's on your floor,
racist people, you know, saying dumb things to you.
And you're not necessarily safe in those spaces. Like, and a dorm is not like the super safe space if someone hates you down the floor, you know, the
like right next door to you.
And then
you're having to navigate that. That's like too much. I feel it's a weird experience. I don't know. Like, I just keep telling you, I was like, make sure you buddy up. Get your crew. Because you're going into spaces that are not meant for you. You know.
And RAs don't necessarily know how to deal with that.
Right.
Because like, they're like your age. And they're not trained.
It's a big RAs. Oh my goodness. Trying. Just trying.
So many people are not made for conflict. They're really not.
Exactly.
So it's like, we're New Yorkers. We're like, so what's the problem? And people are not ready for that. They're like, what? You leave New York, people are like, it's like, no, what's the problem?
Oh, that's the funniest thing, but it's the truth. Because I'm like immediately I have to talk to him. Right? Like, to me, that's how I come into this. Sometimes there's a problem, who do I have to talk to?
You know?
But that's just because I come from the Bronx, and you're just like, what the hell?
You mean Evie could form like this like trifecta from each borough, like Queens, Brooklyn, and the Bronx? It's like the what's good trio.
You know what the funny thing is? I think we were, where were we? I think we were in Boston or something, and everyone had to stand up and say something. And Evie, myself, and Jason was sitting next to me. I think Evie and I said something that was pretty much like violence inflict. Like, you were like, we will, whatever, our character would like kick someone's butt or something like that. And Jason made a note, like, of course, you guys are from New York. Like, what?
That's establish this right now.
You just like looking like you and Evie. You're like, I don't see the problem.
People ain't ready. It's like, y'all can't handle this.
I know.
It's like, we're not here for your whatever.
This is like, you know, this is normal for us.
It really is. I don't feel like that's confrontational. I just feel like that's us being open.
Exactly.
Jeez. And then add in that we're like women of color, and this is like a whole other bag of worms.
It really is. It's really funny because we both had similar answers, and Jason was like, pick that out. And we were just like, shrug.
Oh, well. I don't know if that's when I talk to Renee, because she's very direct too, but it's a total different method of directness. And I don't know if that's because she's from Portland.
I think or it does.
She used to actually manage conflict with children, so she worked in social justice. So I wonder if it's partly that.
That might be true. That's right. Because I remember she worked at Dream Yard too, which is so funny. And I love Renee. I love her book. I feel like our books have a both Jade and Margot had a conversation together. Like, we joked about it. Like, yeah, I don't know if they like each other, but eventually it would be okay. Because they're both struggling. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I feel like Jade might be like, Margot, you got to get with the program a little bit.
Jade would be like, telling off. It's so funny because literally when I first met her, I was like, yeah, Margot would have to be told off by Jade. It would be great.
She's getting there.
Yes.
Hang out with Margot, man. She will not disappoint. So, can we talk a little bit about Dealing in Dreams, which is your next book?
Yeah, Dealing in Dreams.
It's different.
Yes. Yeah, it's different. It's near future. Mm-hmm. It's set in a world where girl gangs kind of rule the streets of this world, of this city.
Were you thinking of The Warriors a little bit when you...
Definitely thinking about The Warriors. I mean, I grew up watching that film. Mm-hmm. So, and it starts... that film starts in the Bronx. So I always was fascinated with that film. Oh, but I'm also like, I grew up watching boxing. Mm. So I could see the beauty in boxing mm-hmm. as a sport. And I like to watch it a lot. I wanted to write this story about gender roles being flipped a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this pursuit, again, of, like, the dreams, right? It's, like, this dream of... Dreams in this world is really sueños and their drugs that these girl gangs are kind of, like, they, give out to the people. Mm-hmm. So they play up all these things of, like, the opiate epidemic or the crack epidemic, mm-hmm. how it comes down to people of color and mm-hmm. how you're just sort of stuck in this world and then this... False, like, dreams of you can make it here. Like, that's that mentality mm-hmm, of New York. Mm-hmm. You can make it in New York. You can make it anywhere. But really, that's not true. You have to have a lot of money and power. So there's that moment when I was rewriting this, because I wrote this story a long time ago, like 6 years ago.
The novel as a novel?
Yeah, the first draft. Because, mm-hmm. I write drafts fairly easy, quickly. But I wrote it for 6 years and then I didn't look at it. I wrote it the draft and I didn't mm-hmm. look at it again. When I got the 2-book deal, then I had to obviously look at it. So I looked at it again, I guess last year, and, rewrite it and stuff. But at that moment, Trump had just been elected and everyone was like going up those elevators to the towers to maneuver to get their spots, right? Mm. And I just kept thinking about that. It's like this moment of like, it plays into gentrification as well in that everyone wants to get into these houses. And I think of like housing projects being these social experiments that somewhat failed. And what would that mean if housing projects are no longer housing projects because they become condos? And so then all of a sudden people want to get in there, and it's just like this really weird thing of what it means to the dream. What are these dreams? I wanted to write about that and write about violence and gender roles and flip those and that's what I wrote.
And that's coming out 2019?
Yeah, 2019, March 2019. Super excited about it. I mean, it's set in the Bronx, but you wouldn't know that unless you were from the Bronx.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't really say it's from the Bronx, but there are certain things that if you're from the Bronx, you would know.
Okay, so they're markers.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but not like really overt because everything sort of changed. Yeah, I'm really excited. It's a different take, but I guess it's in the same kind of world of Margot, just dealing with the same themes and always circling around, addiction and gentrification and using what is out there. Does it really work for people of color? I don't know if it does. Mm-hmm. It's just that moment of like, you think about even when Kanye took the elevator up, see Trump. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, he's going to take that elevator up. I'm kind of fascinated with that, with people of color who are trying to play the game, but they don't see that the game is rigged.
Yeah.
Like that, I'm fascinated by those people. So so it's like Kanye and it's the governor of Puerto Rico, Rosario, who takes a selfie with Trump when Trump is, like, throwing throwing paper towels at people. These are people who are, like, trying to...
Omarosa.
Yeah, like, maneuvering themselves into who has the power and seeing that they're never going to be in that circle, mm-mm. no matter what you do.
Yeah. It's kind of disturbing to think people... It never happens to you, right? And that's kind of very privileged thinking. Like, this isn't going to happen to me.
Yes. How could it possibly happen to me?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're playing the game, right? Right? Yeah, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
And so that means I'm going to win.
Yeah.
And that's not possible because they're not here for you to win. They're here for you to step over you. Mm-hmm. There was an article I think it was the Atlantic. We're talking about the opiate, the family who created the drug, right? It's like this big family, powerful family, whatever. And they did the history of it. And mm-hmm. it was fascinating. And then there's this one throwaway sentence. And it says the island of Puerto Rico was sent generic samples of, you know, were sent these drugs. It was just like a little sentence of like, even the island of Puerto Rico is still being used as experimentation for drugs. This is now, we're talking about 2017, mm-hmm. 2016, mm-hmm. whenever that was. They're still being used as guinea pigs for American drugs. So I'm just like, we're still doing that. This is not, these are, even if my book is in the near future, it's just, it's now.
Those are going to be some interesting combos with the young peeps.
I'm gonna grab it. I was like, this is going to be fun. Yeah, I mean, who knows? They might say, like, oh, girls, fierce. It's going to be fierce girls kicking ass. That is true.
Yeah, yeah.
You get that. But yeah. I'm also talking about, does violence really work? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's true. Like, does, you know, all these marches, you know, I'm always like, it's amazing. Like, the Women's March, and then, but it's like, Black Lives Matter. What's the better march? You know what I mean? Like, what works?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm just like, and I don't have the answer for any of that. But I would love when want to talk to kids about that stuff.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to have those conversations with kids because they're coming from very different points of views. And I'm fascinated by that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. All kinds of kids need to hear that.
Yeah. Conversation. It'll be fun. So I'm excited to see how that turns out.
I'm excited for it. I was reading the copy. I said, woo. This is something completely different.
Yeah,
but, you know, hearing about your clarion background and everything, and you won a Penn Center Award and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's not like you're new to this. Like, you know, you've been
putting
your strategy. There's some strategy.
Exactly. I was like, yeah. Basically, yeah. Like me anyway, like, yeah. We've been at it for a while, but we don't know what we're doing. But I feel like, there is strategy. I want to write my coming of age story. I want to write this one. The next one, I'm not sure. I know I have a draft of it and I sense it. But it's a retelling, you know, and I want to be able to write those kind of like just jump this way.
Yeah.
Into like one thing because I get bored easily. It's my reading. It's like I want to read a lot of different things.
Yeah.
So that's the way I view writing, my writing life.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I will never write poetry again, though, because I'm...
Oh, gosh, I can never do that. Mm-mm. Like, that's the one thing I will not do. Yeah. I'll leave to the experts. Because I love poetry so much, I would mess it up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I wrote it in high school, and it was horribly, horribly emo. Super emo. Super over... I was in the Dickinson.
Yes.
So everything was symbolic for, like, my period or some shit. Because that was like the hardest thing I knew in life. It's like
so hard.
Oh my god. You guys.
I mean, I would love to like one day take a class with a poet just to try. Because I honestly have no idea about poetry. Like I know I read it and stuff and I'm just in awe of it. But yeah, maybe one day I'll challenge myself to take a class.
Well, I adored Margot Sanchez.
Thank
and I gobbled
you.
It up. And I really loved the writing and the character development and just seeing where things were going because I'm like, this isn't good.
That girl was going to be like,
like, something's up.
Yeah.
And Margot's like, almost there. I'm like, nope. I don't think it's that.
It's so true.
I don't think it's that at all.
I know. I get, like, people emailing me, like, so what happens next? I'm like, I don't know, man. What happens to Margot? I don't know. Her family's a mess. But it'll be interesting to see how it turns out.
I hope
out.
Her mother gets her.
I don't know if that's true. I don't know. I just like that Margot was just talking to Moises.
Like, yeah.
It's like, all right. Who knows what happens?
I'm glad she gets her friend back. I think it's good to have
Yeah, the Elizabeth. I think, really, the relationship is the Elizabeth relationship.
Yeah, that was important.
To me, yeah. Because I love kind of, like, I feel friendships are really important in high school, so they kind of shape everything.
Yeah.
So when you break up with your friends, that's a huge grieving process.
It is.
Yeah.
I remember Yaki Delgado, that was a big thing, too.
Yes.
Like, they both go to different schools.
Right.
And Yaki feels similar. Not Yaki, sorry. Like, the main character, because Yaki's, like, a villain.
Yeah, it's the villain. That book is so good.
It's such an amazing book. And Queens. I guess, see these New York books.
Queens.
My New York books are like, Yes! Ooh, we should do like an intra-borough thing.
We should totally have it. It should be an event and it should just be girls talking about New York.
Yes.
Like YA.
Yes, like you, EB, Meg, and Liz. And that hits pretty much every place except Staten Island.
Who's doing Staten Island?
Nobody. I mean, Alex is not a person of color. Alex Gino is from Staten Island.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, Alex Gino, they wrote George and their new book. Oh, you don't know everything, Jilly P is coming out. Talks a lot about white privilege.
Yeah, really good.
Another great book.
But that would be a really good panel.
Yeah, like get like all the boroughs. Yeah.
I like that. There's somebody who make that happen.
Someone give me money. I'll make it happen.
Make it happen.
How do we get this to happen? We're like Brooklyn Book Fest, maybe. We're like,
That would be a really, really fun conversation to have.
Yeah, New York stories through the woman of color.
Through women of color.
Yeah, boom.
Everybody show up.
I'm going to tag Brooklyn Book Fest when this episode goes live. And listen to the last 5 minutes where we pitched you a panel.
We gave you the names. It's all set up.
I know exactly how this is going to go. I'll moderate. It'll be great.
It'll be great.
Or I'll get y'all on Skype and we'll make it. I don't care.
I mean, people would be down to hear that. That would be a really good conversation.
Like, talk about these stories of like the boroughs and how you give them life and they're not all dank and horrible.
Yeah.
But they also, all of your stories kind of speak to neighborhoods changing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All of it is gentrification situation happening. Wait, so where's Elizabeth at?
Harlem.
That's cool. See? It's all about changing how girls are dealing with it.
Yeah.
Because that's different, though.
Yeah. And there's a lot of patriarchy in all your books. A lot of speaking to, like, these female expectations. So I really like that about the mother when she was being kind of funky. She came in and she was like, this is my house.
She was like, I'm feeding y'all, and this is my house.
That's what tipped me off. I was like,
She's laying claim right now, y'all. I'm showing up today, and the father's like hiding in the office.
She brought the food. She's looking great. You know, it's like everything is in place with the heat. I was like, yep.
So good.
I would kind of do that too. I'd be like, okay.
I mean, where else would she exude power? She's not working in the supermarket anymore. Her husband's not really somewhat now allowing her to. So
yeah,
it was really
That was a very interesting scene, and it was funny how Margot reacted to it. Margot's like, hey, and it's just like, no, this is that alpha female thing. Yes, it is. Where you're laying claim to your stuff.
Oh my god. So crazy. Oh no. People do that. It's amazing.
Well, thank you so much, Lillian, for talking to me about this amazing book and your next book.
Thank you.
Stealing
so in
Dreams.
Yes.
Reminder. How many people connect with you, find more about your stuff?
Yeah, everyone, you can find me. I have a website, obviously. It's LillianRivera.com, but you can always find me on Twitter at LilliamR. That's usually where I live. Mm-hmm. And on Instagram, too, the same thing, LilliamR. But I'm on Twitter.
That's where her agent's following
her. That's where the agent emails me. Are you okay? Yes. Yes, I am.
So you wrote this morning. It has some froyo.
How's it going? I'll be like, okay. It's good. No, thanks for having me. It was really fun.
And thank you again for listening. This is Minorities in Publishing, which you can find at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and on Twitter at minoritiesinpub, as well as on TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, and iTunes. Thanks again.